Hi, and welcome to a new series of Let's Make a Difference podcasts. Now, this is an interesting topic that I've been thinking about for a while. It's about people that have left employment to start their own business. Now, I've always thought this was very brave, but equally very scary. So I wanted to talk to a few people that have been there and done it. So let's see how we get on. In my fourth episode, I'm talking to James Cook, who was a freelance videographer or film producer, but has now launched his own studio. Let's talk to James and see what he has to say and find out more about his experiences. So a big welcome to James Cook, who is, I think, my fourth guest on this series of this podcast. James, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, mate. It's been way too long. I'm very looking forward to chatting with you this afternoon.
Yeah, it's for context. I think I met James probably about 10 years ago now. He was very young. I mean, James still looks babyface. Obviously, this is a podcast, so people can't see you, but I can see you at the moment. And you're still very babyface, but you were even more babyface then. But you've had some sort of natural talent, I remember, with just editing and doing videos and even actually hosting podcasts and stuff like that. But your skill was in the kind of editorial and production side. And I remember we did some really good videos, didn't we, in the Tollington pub of kind of, you know, live podcasts. We did financial videos for the AST. We also did a couple of promo videos for the AST as well. So yeah, it's been quite a journey.
Yeah, certainly has. And looking back at those pieces, I mean, you say they were good, but I look back at them, I'm like, oh my God. You know, I try not to look back at them, to be honest. Yeah, I'm like, I wish I could do them again, you know, just to make them even better. But I suppose, I'm sure we'll go on to talk about it a little bit later, but that's how you kind of get started in your career. You learn from your mistakes, you learn, you know, what could be better, what could be improved upon. And without that sort of work, I don't think I'd be producing the sort of stuff that I am now.
I mean, even now, when I look back at sort of social campaigns and posts and assets that I might have created 10 years ago, I think, bloody hell, how bad were they? But as you say, everyone starts somewhere, you need to learn. And also in those 10 years ago, what's good then is different now, if you know what I mean. Like now, actually, if I think about social, it went through a phase where 10, 15 years ago, it was very much raw, unpolished stuff. Then we went to this period where actually polished stuff, you're looking really crisp work. But now we've gone back, like TikTok, if you think about TikTok, it's gone back to very raw, you know, in production, TikTok produces it itself kind of thing. You can edit within TikTok. We don't need, so it's gone the other way in social a little bit as well, and things like that. So things change, and I think that's just got to kind of stick with the trend a little bit. But James, take me back to, obviously, the whole point of this series has been about kind of people that have, you know, entrepreneurs who have potentially taken that big step from an employer to starting their own business. It can be very nervy. It can be very scary. It can be, you know, a lot of people want to do it, but just don't know how to go about it. So this is what this series is about. So if you take me back to kind of the start, I guess, you know, education, when did you sort of, was kind of production and film and stuff like that, was it a passion right from day one, or did you kind of pick it up or sort of as you went along?
I kind of fell into it. I think that's how a lot of people fall into it. It wasn't something that I planned to do. I certainly wasn't sat at school thinking I want to be the next Steven Spielberg. It wasn't something that, from like a really young age, I never really thought and considered being a genuine career path. I just didn't know about it, to be honest with you. It was only when I started sixth form at the age of 16 when I actually didn't get good enough GCSEs to do the A-levels that I had originally applied for. So I think there was something like history and English literature or something like that. And they said, well, we can't offer you that, but to go alongside the other courses you've chosen, we'd like to give you the option of doing film studies. And, you know, at that age, film studies kind of looked as a bit of a, not a film studies, what do? You just watch films all day. And yeah, I mean, you know, that is partly true. An aspect of the course was watching films, but I took that on, and we did a lot of theory-based stuff. We did a lot of practical-based stuff in terms of cameras and kind of where I learned to edit and things like that. And that's kind of where it started. But to coincide with that, I also started a YouTube channel focusing on football at the time. So I'm an avid Arsenal fan, as you know, and I started my own YouTube platform, which is, I would say, although my education has been fantastic and I've learned a lot from it, being self-taught and learning a lot of stuff through platforms such as YouTube in terms of editing and things like that. It also gave me that ability to host and do the sort of thing that we're doing now. I just presented YouTube videos. I tried to edit them. I tried to make the production value go up and up and up as each year went by. And that's kind of where it started for me. And from there, you know, I collaborated with people such as yourself. And it's just from that foundation, it's just grown and grown and grown. And it's, gotten to the point now where I'm unfortunately not doing a lot of football-based stuff, but I am producing a lot of what I would regard as more premium videos. And even though I'm not in front of the camera, very rarely, in fact, I am taking those skills that I learned maybe 10, 12 years ago and applying it to the work I'm doing now. So, yeah, that's kind of how it started.
I got a flashback, actually, from we interviewed David Seaman, didn't we? We went up to London to some kind of offices where he was doing some work, and we got to interview. And I remember you brought your cameras as well, and we kind of had two cameras fixed. And I think you sat in the interview as well, kind of co-hosted it and stuff like that. And it was quite impressive to be able to film and host at the same time, which is essentially what you did.
But, well, it was quite nerve-wracking at the time. I do remember that, because obviously you're coming up with a big personality with David Seaman, and at being an Arsenal fan, you know, kind of a bit starstruck in those situations. Yeah. And the thought of having to juggle not only two cameras, and you can't see those cameras because you're in front of them as well, being part of the discussion, but then also the audio aspect, you know, I wasn't able to monitor that. So praying that comes out okay. So yeah, there were a lot of different facets to that shoot that even now would still, you know, make me a little bit anxious, but
worked out though.
It did. And it was a great video. It was a great experience to be part of that interview, and also to, you know, produce something that, even looking back, I think we did that about 6-7 years ago. The quality of it was, I think it was good.
Good, yeah. So you kind of finished film studies at education level and stuff like that. What was kind of the next step for you? Did you kind of start to try and get experience? Did you do an internship? How did you sort of get into it? Because I know you kind of did some work with Crystal Palace eventually, but before all that, what did you sort of do to get that career going?
So in the years between when I finished sixth form and graduated from university, that first year out of sixth form, I wasn't actually too sure what I was going to do. And I applied for jobs in places like retail, Primark, Next, those sort of places. But then I eventually did go back to sixth form for an additional year, just whilst I kind of figured myself out and worked out what exactly I wanted to do. I did a foundation course in art, which wasn't really, you know, the route I wanted to go down, but they said I could explore video when I did that course. So it seemed like a good fit. I was able to explore my passion, and also it meant I was able to get another qualification, which aided my uni application, which is what I eventually decided to do. So it was around late 2014 that I started working with TIFO Football, which is quite a popular outlet now. They were previously known as UMaxit Football, which was like a predictor game, and they were very, very different to what they are now, but they were just starting to explore content and they had no real capacity for editing or video production. So I just came on board just doing very basic YouTube edits for them. But at the time, for me, they were quite complex.
Yeah.
I gradually started doing more and more work with them. That then evolved into doing actual video pieces where I would talk about, you know, five hot topics in football, five players to watch in, you know, 2015 or whatever. And then it eventually evolved even further to doing mini documentaries, which is kind of where I started. And I actually interviewed you in one of them regarding ticket pricing in football. So that was where I would say the more production element of it came into focus. And that's what I was doing in that period where I was doing the foundation course. And then I went on to go to university, and that's where I found the freelancy kind of work that I was doing just went to another level. I started working with agencies. I worked with some big clients, Penguin Random House, and Budweiser off the top of my head. There's a few others I was in there. And that's kind of where I moved away from the football side of things and went more into business. I worked with a company, a startup called Kids Know Best, which I learned a hell of a lot from. I started with them in 2017 when they were an organization of just two people. They've now grown to, I think, around 40, 50 people.
Oh, wow.
So I learned a hell of a lot going from, you know, seeing that, and I'm still very much in contact with the guys that run that. So it was a real learning curve, and getting my own clients as well as working on behalf of other clients for agencies such as Kids Know Best. It was, yeah, a very productive experience for me. And I'm glad I did that in my uni years, because as we're going to go on to talk about, I graduated kind of in a good position because I'd had that experience. I wasn't having to leave uni, not having gone out and got that experience. And, you know, maybe if I hadn't have done that, I would be a few years away from where I am now, if that makes sense.
And from a practical perspective, anyone sort of maybe thinking about the same thing, and who's, I mean, no doubt all the stuff you did for your own YouTube channel and stuff helped, because not only did you get a bit of experience, you were self-teaching yourself, but you had a bit of a portfolio to show people, because I think without that, you might have struggled. But, I mean, you talked about agencies and Penguin and Budweiser, but I mean, how, from a practical sense, did you get that work? Or did you, was it like applying for actual roles, or was it through third-party people? Like, how was it?
So I never applied for anything. Reason being because, not to sound arrogant, but I was in uni at the time. So it wasn't, you know, I wouldn't apply for a full-time or part-time job in like my career aspirations, because it wouldn't make sense whilst I was still studying and had ambitions to finish my course. So it was very fortunate, to be honest with you. So you meet people through, I used to post a lot on LinkedIn, I still do, and you might get someone that gets in touch, they offer you a small gig, and then you start working with that person more and more. And then, for example, Kids Know Best, who were a client that I worked with a hell of a lot whilst I was at university, I just happened to bump into them as part of another shoot. We were hiring the studio that they worked out of, got chatting to the guy, and it just led down that path. So I would say it's a lot of luck, I think, but you've got to be in the position to meet those people. So you've got to put yourself out there, and I think naturally the more you do that, the more you'll find those opportunities arise.
I mean, you say it's luck, it's probably more than that though as well. It's the fact that you were actually out there trying to get experience, the fact that you were putting yourself out there by putting YouTube videos up and things like that. It's kind of a, you know, without that, you wouldn't get spotted and you wouldn't be in the right place, if you know what I mean. I mean, even me, when people say to me, like, you know, how should I'm young, I'm at school or uni, and I want to go into social media, what should I do? My answer is always build your own kind of profiles, get out there on your own Instagram, your own TikTok, your own Twitter, start tweeting, start posting things, you know, write a blog maybe, or of anything you're interested in, just to get yourself out there. Maybe have a YouTube channel to get yourself out there, because actually that's when people will see. And you mentioned LinkedIn, stuff like that is always good as well. And it's just getting experience. I would say if you're young and you can do it, you just go out and work for free. Like, you know, if they can pay expenses, you know, I would always ask for expenses, and I wouldn't expect anyone to work totally for free. But if I can, you know, get someone, if I can pay for their travel and their lunch, I think, or at least that's something for them to then get experience, build their portfolio, and then they can obviously grow. And I think it seems like it was quite similar for you in that kind of path.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned doing work pro bono, and I mean, that's kind of where this discussion has stemmed from, because you saw a LinkedIn post where I was talking about why I think that's a positive thing for young people to do. And you know, I had mixed responses to that. A lot of people actively encouraging it, a lot of professionals saying, oh, you should never do work for free. And I think you've kind of got to accept, depending on where you are in your journey, if you've not got a portfolio of work and you've not got a network, I think even if you're an established professional, if you've just started your own business and you've not got clients that are truly your own, you might have a great portfolio, but that might be work that, you know, you're under an NDA to sign, or it's work you've done for an employer that they don't want you to share and say you've done it yourself, because they want to put it as their work, essentially. So although you might have great work that you've done before, if it's not truly work that is of a client that you've worked directly with and built a relationship with, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing pro bono work. And I wouldn't say I was an established business or ultimate professional at the age that I was doing pro bono work. I was just 24. So you'd think at that age, it's quite young, but also you want to be making money at that point. For me, I was in the middle of the pandemic. I'd started my business about 5-6 months earlier. I hadn't worked for several months. And as soon as we came out of that first lockdown in the middle of 2020, I was like, right, okay, I really need to do some work, because I understand nobody's got any money, but I need to show that I'm just not just sitting around resting on my laurels. So I went out to businesses that were, you know, companies that I got an opportunity to work directly with, that I could say I've managed this project from start to finish. And I just did that for about 2 months. And it's amazing how much work you can get done in 2 months. And I think had I not done that, I wouldn't have, you know, been reputable in my local area. I wouldn't have got clients in my local area. Because although you might think, even though, you know, you're working in a video aspect or design aspect, I certainly thought there wouldn't be much work in my local community for that sort of thing, but I've been really surprised by how much cool there is within like a 5 mile radius of where I live. So I mean businesses around you do certainly have budget for this sort of thing in a lot of cases. So it's trying to convince people, showing people what you can do. And yeah, I'm a big advocate of doing the pro bono thing, but it's just knowing when to stop doing it and knowing when you're being taken advantage of. And when you get to a point where there's quite a high demand for it. And I think you'll recognize when the work is of high enough quality that you should be charging. So it's knowing when to do it, where to do it. And ultimately just being sensible with it and not being taken advantage of and not giving everything away for free. I don't think you should necessarily give clients the full scale of your service, but rather give them something that's going to be a benefit and quality to them, but leave them wanting more.
I mean, that work for free is quite an interesting thing. And I always think when you're young, I think you sort of have to do it a little bit. And then when you're young, it's when you have less risks. It's potentially when you don't have a mortgage, you don't have children, you don't have dependents, you may be lucky enough still to live with your parents or family, where, you know, you may or may not pay rent or you may contribute, but it's always going to be a little bit less pressure than maybe later on in life. So I think if you've got no experience, I think working for, I don't think there's any shame in that. As I said, if they can pay expenses, I wouldn't, you know, if someone said to me, oh yeah, can you work for free, but can you come up to Manchester to do it on a £100 train? I probably would advise someone to say, well, don't do that unless they're going to pay for that train. Don't do that sort of thing. But I think, you know, if it's kind of not costing you anything, but you're getting experience, I think it's great. Where I have a problem with it is actually when people start their own business. That's when I think working for free is a little bit different. And I remember I saw, you know, a quote from someone half famous, I can't remember, but it was just like, if any of your friends or family start a business, support them. Don't ask them for a discount, support them, because you wouldn't go to Tesco and ask for a discount there. And that's a multi-million pound business, established business, but you're not asking for a discount there. So why are you asking your friends and family who have just started a business for a discount? So that's always stayed with me. And now I always think, I've got, you know, a cousin who's a photographer and stuff, and occasionally I've done some events and stuff and he's helped me with them, and I've always tried to say no, I might not be able to pay you too much because it might be a charity gig, but I don't want you to do it for free. I want you to be able to make some money, because it's just not fair otherwise. So I think if you're working for free when you're young, no problem with it. I think if you can just get your expenses paid, great. As you get older and as you get more responsibilities, you may start your own business. I think that's when actually you learn who your friends and family really are, I think, and that's important. So James, it's a good segue on now. So you've worked for a few people, you've done all your education, you briefly just mentioned it, but then you sort of decided you want to build your own business, you want to work for yourself, you want to, you know, have your own brand and stuff like that. So tell me a little bit about the mindset then. When did you think about, okay, I want to do it myself, I want to have a name, a logo, all that kind of stuff, and how hard was it to actually transition to that? Because it is very brave, believe me, it's very brave to do that. I tried to do that. 2 months later, I went back into a full-time gig, did a little bit of the freelance stuff, but went into a full-time gig because I just thought, you know what, I don't know if I can do this. Like, I don't know, I'm it scares me that I don't know where my next job is coming from. But you did it. Fair play to you, but tell me a little bit about that process and that journey.
Yeah, I can certainly understand from your point of view why you might have that apprehension with it. I think with someone like yourself, where you've had a long-term employee background, making that jump, you know, like you say, you left it after 2 months, it is daunting. And especially if you're just going out for the first time, it's so different to the world of employment. So I think that's how a lot of people feel about it. And particularly if you've been in a stable career for, let's say, 10, 15, 20 years, and then you decide, okay, I'm going to go for it. I think it would be
It wasn't
so...
20 years, I'm not that.
No, not you.
I know.
It's so much more difficult to make that jump at that period in your career than it was for me, because it's just all I'd done. So I'd built up a network from, well, essentially from the age of 18. And that was a real benefit to me, because although, you know, I'm not regularly working with particular clients, well, I am, but you know what I mean? Like, I don't have retainers or things like that. There's a large network of people, and I've kind of got that luxury that any one of them could pop up at any time. So one could pop up that I haven't spoken to for 5, 6, 7 years. So it's really strange how work comes about. But when I left university, when I graduated, my ambitions were kind of mixed. I wasn't too sure what I was going to do. I was kind of hit that block, similarly to when I'd left sixth form, in terms of, okay, education's behind me now, what am I going to do? And I'd worked with a lot of freelance clients throughout university. My options were, I can go full-time on the freelance thing, or I can try and get a job in football media. So as you know, that's been a big passion of mine. Yeah. And when I left uni, I was like, right, I really would like to see if I can get something with a company like Joe or Bleacher Report or somewhere, and, you know, really follow that career of doing football documentaries, creating content around football, because that was a huge passion of mine. And ultimately, I did interview for a load of jobs. I interviewed with Bleacher Report. I did interview with Joe. I interviewed with Arsenal, in fact, and I didn't get a job. And at the point, I was like, I was a bit downbeat, but my attitude was, okay, well, that's not happened, so let's go back to the other option, which is the freelance thing. So I did that, and I had two regular clients from the middle of 2018 when I graduated to the end of 2018. And things were pretty steady. You know, I had these two regular clients, but it wasn't really, there wasn't much beyond that. It was just those two clients. And then 2019 came around, and at the same time, both of those guys said, look, we can't work with you anymore. You know, we can't, I'm not sure it was the case we couldn't afford it, but the work just wasn't there. I went through a period of a little bit of panic, I suppose, because obviously previously I'd had my education plus my freelance work, so things were quite busy almost all the time. Whereas at the start of 2019, it was the first real quiet period I'd had. And obviously we're talking about this 4.5 years later. I know that the start of the year is generally quiet. So I maybe shouldn't have rushed into the decision that I made, but I applied for hell of a lot of jobs. I just went on LinkedIn, Indeed, you know, any sort of job application. Just search the word video, and I would apply for practically everything. And I'm not ashamed to say, you know, I went for a job. They offered it to me. I went in on the first day. I was like, this was a terrible mistake. And I just held my hands up and said, look, this wasn't for me. I left that job. And thankfully, not too long after that, I was lucky enough to get a job with a great company that I really enjoyed working for, really enjoyed the people, the autonomy, the work I was doing. And that happened to coincide with a regular freelance gig with Crystal Palace. So I was working with them 1-2 days a week. So it's quite nice to actually get my foot in with football media, but not so much that I was full time in it, and also get experience in a completely different industry as well, where I was working with, you know, quite big brands, and I was creating a completely different type of content. So I really enjoyed the majority of 2019, although it was very busy working, you know, this job 4 days a week, and then working with Crystal Palace on the weekends and a day in the week. It was, yeah, a real nice mixture of stuff. And funnily enough, I interviewed with Crystal Palace for a full-time job, and I just happened to get that freelance work because they had someone leave the company and said, we liked what you did on the interview day, have a freelance gig. And that stemmed through all the way through to the pandemic. So yeah, it's funny how these gigs can come about. And in answer to your question, I think I decided I wanted to start my own business probably latter part of 2019. I always thought a business was a bit beyond my means, because it sounds different to freelance, if you know what I mean. It feels a lot.
But essentially, it is the same thing, isn't it?
I mean, I guess it depends how you label yourself. I wanted to move away from the term freelancer, because when I think of freelancer, I think of someone that is going to come in for a day
and just do the job and go.
The job and go. Yeah, whereas I didn't want to be that. I wanted to be seen as someone that would go into a business, strategize with what they want to do, come up with a plan, speak to
be part of it.
And deliver something that was just more than what a freelancer could do. And that's not to say that freelancers can't do that. They absolutely can. I've done it as a freelancer, but I just wanted to move away from that sort of ideology and mindset a little bit. But I was really enjoying my job, as I say, towards the end of 2019. And it was a case of, for me, the work just got a little bit too repetitive, and I was getting quite a lot of freelance work at the time. So I was like, right, I'm going to make the decision end of 2019. I'm going to leave the job and make a go for it. And that's what I did at the start of 2020. I built the Foster Studios brand. And it was a slow burner at the start because, you're having to go direct to client, make new contacts, meet new people. Also a bit of reliance on previous clients to come back to you. And obviously I reached out to everyone I previously worked with, saw if there was anything there. And I mean, those first few months of 2020, as I said earlier, the start of the year is generally slow. So it was difficult. But then March, things started to go really well. And then, well, we know what happened next to the pandemic. So yeah, that's kind of how it came about.
When I spoke to one of the other people on this series, I think I asked them, like, what tips would you give? And I'm going to ask you at the end as well. But what tip would you give someone who's young, who potentially might want to go into? And one of the tips they said was just sort of learn about the business side of it, i.e. how to register at company's house, what you have to, you know, give, what the stuff you have to submit every year and stuff like that, because all that is... it's legal, you have to sort of do it. From your perspective, now you take videos, you produce them, you edit them, it's all very different to putting in details on company's house and stuff. But how did you sort of go about that? Did you get advice from someone, or did you teach yourself? How did you, all that legal bit? Because I think that scares people, if I'm honest, that it kind of puts people off from thinking, oh, do I want to start my own business? I just don't get how all that works. But how was it for you?
It was a bit daunting. I would say to anyone that's thinking of actually incorporating as a business, not to worry about that in the slightest, because it's a 5-minute thing, and it's, you know, it's not going to affect your credit score or anything like that. Yeah. So yeah, don't worry about that. Anyone can do it. It's a really simple process. But in terms of the actual logistics of running a business day to day, it's a constant learning curve. I mean, you could speak to someone for an hour plus, and there would still be things that you would learn a year further down the line that hadn't been brought up in that discussion. So it is very much learning as you go. For me, where I previously freelanced, I kind of knew the ins and outs of invoice processing and how things work. But for me, as I've grown, it's been more a case of, okay, when do I need to get that invoice in to ensure I'm paid on time? Because a lot of the time previously I would do the work and then I would send the invoice, whereas now I'm kind of like, right, I need to get that invoice in earlier, because projects can drag on and on and on. If you're leaving it right to the end, you might not get paid for 6 months. So it's that's been a learning curve. But also there's loads of things that you need to be wary of. How you speak to clients, phrases you use, how you approach proposals, in terms of like how do you react to amends and things like that. There's a lot to consider, and I think if you haven't got the kind of business acumen to go alongside the actual service you provide, that can be a little bit detrimental. But it's not to say that I'm a massive business brain, and I think it's something you learn on as you go. And if you're punctual, communicative, which for me is right at the top of the tree, if you've got communication that's really good, then you will have no problems attracting clients and making clients some of your best friends, because they really do appreciate that if you're transparent and leave no stone unturned. It's not always easy to have those discussions, but sometimes you have to be quite blunt, and so long as you word it in a nice way, it makes the process a lot easier. So I think it's been, I'm still learning as I go. I mean, like I say, I've gone through the ringer. I've been to small claims courts with clients, unfortunately. You know, I've seen kind of all the ends of the spectrum. But then again,
is that when you've done the work and people just haven't paid, simply?
Yeah, so it's only happened once. You know, I think any small business owner has had a situation where a client has taken a long time to pay. And generally, you know, it's very rare that a client won't pay. But in this particular instance, the client just refused, went completely quiet. There was nothing wrong with the deliverables. So it was, kind of, for me, it was a very small amount. So again, like I was saying previously, I wanted to learn these things early on. So I was like, well, you know, they've not paid me. I've not got any relationship with this client. They've come out completely out of the blue. I've got to do the small claims thing out of principle. And, you know, it's not for a catastrophic amount. So,
but still, when you're young, potentially, whatever the amount was, it's still important.
Yeah, it's just the principle of it.
It could be 50 quid. It could be 5,000 quid. It's still, money's money, right? It's important to people. And that's where I think people should be, you know, business owners should be a little bit more, a bit more considerate. I think it's, or at least communicate and not go quiet.
It's not always business owners, I would say. A lot of the time, with a lot of my clients now, if they're quite large businesses, they've got completely separate finance teams. Right. So let's say I'm working with a marketing manager, they'll have a finance team based, you know, might not even be in the same office as them. So yeah. It can be, you know, you're going through two rounds of people essentially. So it can be another layer of process.
Quite recently where I worked with an agency on like an influencer event. And we had influencers in, all done a great job. I was there on the night, got to know them all really well. And, you know, sort of we all hooked up on Instagram a little bit because I was trying to keep it, it's about networking, keeping in touch with people. But it was only about a couple of months after where one or two of them contacted me and it looked like they'd all had a bit of a chat between them. They didn't know each other until the night, but a chat between them and it ended up that they hadn't actually been paid. And it was my night. I had arranged it, even though it was through an agency. So they kind of like came to me a little bit gingerish and said, I haven't actually been paid. I know it's sort of through the agency because we had paid the agency. So in my eyes, we had paid. But they hadn't been paid. And it was just like, oh, wow, okay. So I contacted the agency. And the agency just, they were changing their payment platform and stuff. And they'd had a few teething problems. But within a week of me sort of, or not even a week, a couple of days with of me giving them a little bit of a, come on, get these guys paid, they paid them. So it was all fine in the end. But it's just, yeah, things can sometimes. I mean, I was maybe a bit harsh when I said business owners shouldn't have. But it's you know what I mean? But at the same time, I'm glad that these people contacted me and I could sort it because at the end of the day, it was my night. So it's kind of a, you just have to take responsibility, I guess is what I mean. You know, if the agency had come to me and said, look, it'll be another 4 weeks, but we will pay them, I would have communicated that and said, look, I'm sorry, I know it's not ideal, but this is the situation. But no communication means you think the worst and you think you're not going to be paid. And that's probably not a nice feeling. So I kind of get it. I did say to you that I'm going to ask you kind of, you know, maybe three tips you would give someone young. So someone who, similar to yourself, it could be a different industry. It doesn't have to be kind of, you know, exactly what you do. But if you give them three pieces of advice, they came to you and said, James, I'm sort of interested in this. I'm 18 or 16 at school. What do you recommend me doing? I think I could probably guess one of them, but what advice would you give? What tips would you give?
What's the one that you would guess?
I think it's get that experience. And we both mentioned it. It's the bit about, even if you do have to do your own YouTube channel, your own whatever industry you're working on, if that means working for free a little bit, just do it so you've got something to show people. If I want someone to come and cut my grass, I'm probably still thinking, like, do you have a photo of somebody else's garden you've done? And if they can show me a photo or two that looks like, oh yeah, that grass looks nicely cut, yeah, cool, go ahead. If someone comes and says, no, I haven't got anything really, you just sort of think, oh, okay, have they done this before, sort of thing. So I think that it's just that building that portfolio in whatever field you're in. But I think that's the one I would have guessed, but it might not be.
Yeah, so I mean, it would definitely fall into that category. So I would say find your passion and create content around that. So in my case, it was football. So I made the YouTube channel, I made the football documentaries, and that's where everything started from. But your passion could be something completely different. Like could be food, could be dancing, it could be absolutely anything. So if you find something that you're passionate about, create the content around that because it will make it so much of an easier process because you'll actually be very invested in what you're creating. So the end products, you know, it might not be Hollywood standards, but at least you could look back at it and say, yeah, I'm really proud of that piece. So that would be, yeah, my first tip. Second tip would be to definitely put yourself out there. So exploit social media, make sure you're posting on LinkedIn, make sure the quality of what you're posting is of a good level as well. So don't just post anything, make sure there's a bit of thought behind it and you're ultimately adding value to your audience, whether that's, you know, people within your network in terms of someone that does something similar to what you do, or if you're trying to target clients, how can you put something out that benefits them, whether you're providing transparency on your industry, you're providing tips, that sort of thing. And then the last one would be, I think, like we've just spoken about, be transparent and communicate, particularly the communication one, because I've worked with a hell of a lot of people, whether they be people in my industry that I've worked with as who, you know, might have hired in freelancers, or it might be a client. It could literally anyone. There are so many people out there that can't communicate well. And if you're just able to do that, if you're able to respond to emails promptly, provide clarity on the situation, and, you know, ask questions, be inquisitive, and yeah, just provide clear transparency and communication. Honestly, it will put you head and shoulders above the competition, because it's such an important asset. I really value it. So I would hope that clients really value it. And ultimately, it makes projects and work a lot more enjoyable, a lot smoother. So yeah, communicate well and efficiently.
Mm. I guess the only thing I was thinking of, I would add to that, and people care what I think, but it's kind of like, if you don't ask, you don't get as well. I think of two examples in my life where I've asked, where I thought, no chance, but I thought, let me ask anyway, and that's just, what's the worst that can happen? The first was when I was 18 or so at university. So a bit of what you were saying about putting yourself out there and stuff, that's what I was doing. If people were a lot at Arsenal remember me from the kind of phone-ins and stuff like that, the phone-in shows, because I used to phone in a lot, and then in the end it became a feature and they used to call me, which was actually really nice, but it took 6 months of work for me to get there and stuff. And then, you know, they often had guests, and there was a journalist called John Cross from the Mirror, and he, you know, we had him, I'm sure, as a guest a couple of times when we were doing our podcast. But, you know, I tweeted him a few times, and he used to reply, and it was quite nice, and got to know him a little bit. And I just asked him, I was like, I'm 18, is there any work experience at the Daily Mirror or something? Because I really want to see if journalism is for me. And I thought there would be a massive process. I thought he would be like, I'll put you in touch with our department who deal with that. And then I thought the department will come and say, oh, well, we only take certain people or certain amount of people a year, and you have to apply. But to my thing, he just literally sent someone an email and said, yeah, can you sort out dates for this guy to come in and do 4 weeks or 2 weeks with us or whatever he wants to do, and let me know when he's doing it so I can kind of take him to a couple of press conferences. And within like 2 days, it was sorted, and I was doing 4 weeks at the Mirror. I got to go to Arsene Wenger's press conference. I went Avram Grant at West Ham. I went Harry Redknapp at Spurs. I then wrote pieces on it, which was on the online. Couple went into the newspaper. It was really cool. I mean, by the end of that, I realized journalism isn't for me, but the fact that I asked, I got in. And then the second example was when I started this podcast type thing, I did a series in lockdown that was just around dealing with lockdown, dealing with pressure. I can't, you know, and I interviewed a couple of friends and a couple of people, and I thought, you know, I just want to see if I can get someone a bit more well known a little bit. So I kind of asked around, I cold emailed like agents and said, oh, your client so-and-so, can I, you know, and most of them were a no, apart from one, which was the actress Nina Varadkar. She was on in Goodness Gracious Me, she was in EastEnders, she's done loads of other things. And the agent must have just asked her and said, oh, there's someone's emailed in to ask this, what should I say, no sort of thing. And they're like, she was like, actually, no, if it's on Zoom, We're all in lockdown. We've got nothing to do. Yeah, go on, do it. And she gave me like an hour of her time, did a really nice podcast with her. That's my most viewed podcast ever. And it was just like, oh, if you don't ask, you don't get. So that's the thing I would say. Do ask people things. And you may have to ask 100 times, and 99 might be a no. But the one that is a yes can potentially be so massive for you. And it was massive for me in my podcast, it was massive for me early in my career to realize actually this isn't for me. That's all I would add. Long-winded story, but two examples there that I thought were quite good.
Yeah, you've got to you kind of got to get used to the rejection side of things, don't you? I guess going back to what we discussed earlier in terms of the actual business side of things, it can be quite hard to take rejection and not take it personally, because, you know, if you sent off a proposal and they've either said
you spent hours on that proposal. Presumably.
Exactly. The thing that's frustrating, and it happens all the time, it's just part of sales, unfortunately, but you do just get ghosted. Whether clients or prospective clients want to just not have that awkward conversation or just say no. For me, I've got no problem with rejection, just so long as I know. It's when you're kind of given a date, you put a figure in, and you just don't hear back. That happens a hell of a lot, and that's part of the rejection process that can be a bitter pill to swallow. But like you say, you know, you're going to put loads of proposals in over the course of a year. Chances are one of them is going to say yes. So that would be, I guess, tip number four: don't get too disheartened by any rejections.
Yeah. And that's in any walk of life. I remember I did this. I mean, I won't name the company because I'm sure the personnel, the HR team would have changed, but I went to a first stage interview in Hammersmith. I went for a second stage interview in Hammersmith. thought I really got on with them. I thought, well, this seems all right. I'm in two stages. I've taken time off from that job to actually go to the interviews. Didn't hear a thing after the second stage. Just did not hear a thing. I emailed several times. Just wanted to know if it was like a yes or a no, or is there another stage, or have they pulled the role, or just anything. But it's got nothing. I still to this day think, God, I wish I could see that, because he was a really distinct character and he looks really distinct. He had massive afro hair and stuff like that. So if I saw him, I'll remember him. But just like, how can you treat people like that? It's just, it really makes, yeah, it's tough. And I remember even in roles when we've had to go out for tender to agencies, like we want a bit of work done. And in the corporate world, you normally have to get three quotes because you can't just get one, because it's like, well, how do you know that's the best quote? How do you know that's the going rate? How that could just be your mate that you've got on board. And, you know, like we've heard a lot in politics where people have got their mates, like, you know, giving their jobs to their mates or things. This is the reason why normally you have three. But then sometimes these agencies prepared pitches and they've all come into our office pitch. And I just feel so bad. I'm like, oh my God, I have to pick one, which means I have to say no to two. But they've put so much effort in and they've come all the way here. And I just, oh my God, I hate that part of the role.
Yeah, but I think they will appreciate it if you do say no. And, you know, any decent agency that's worth their salt will say, okay, you said no. Is there any feedback you could give? Yeah. And then it's up to you, really, if you want to say, look, guys, I've not got time to give feedback, but just giving free.
Oh, I always find time because I think it's
invaluable. And I do think, particularly where you mentioned the job interview process, I know a lot of people that have gone through that. And I do think businesses are getting a lot better explaining why they've gone with someone else. I know when I was applying for jobs, I did normally get explanations. And I think that's happening now. But I feel like with businesses as service providers, when they're getting a quote, like you say, if they're trying to get 3, 4, 5 different quotes, they'll focus on the one that's been accepted and then they'll start the ball rolling on the project. So everything else kind of evaporates into the dust. So they don't really feel they should or need to get in touch with them. But I think just as a courtesy thing, you know, I would do it if it was me. But it is what it is. It's just, like I say, it's part of the process.
Yeah, exactly. It is. James, it's been fascinating talking to you. I think, what age were you when you started the Foster Studios? How old were you?
23.
I mean, that's pretty impressive. That.
What I would say though, I know we spoke a lot about very different things throughout this discussion, but I know when you were speaking about coming on and talking about the idea of risk and things like that, I would say to anyone that's of a similar age to what I was when I started, or even potentially even younger, that's a good age to do it, because you've not got that associated risk so much. Like, you've not got a mortgage, you've not got bills, you've not got a wife or kids or husband. There's a good time frame in which to do it, and I think that's a good opportunity to test the waters. You might not be ready, you might go to employment for a couple of years, but if it's something you truly want to do and you really want to work on your own terms, you find a way of making it happening, or making it happen. So I think that's a really good age to do it in.
I can't remember who else. I was listening to a podcast or something the other day when I was driving, and it was someone said the same thing. They were like in their 30s or something and said that they're not now in a position where they could just drop everything and go for an opportunity, if it was abroad or if it was, they're just not in, they just can't do that. They're at a stage of their life where they just can't do that anymore.
That was my worry. I didn't want to get into my 30s and 40s and
regrets.
Yeah, and just be like, well, I wish I'd done this 10 years ago, because now I'm not in a position to give everything up and try and find my own client base. So yeah, I think it was probably the best thing I've ever done, to be honest.
Yeah, one of my biggest regrets is not working abroad when I was younger, in my 20s. I just think that's the time I should have done it. And it's just a bit too late now. People tell me, no, it's not too late. For me, it kind of is. But at the same time, by not working abroad meant I got to do the Arsenal stuff. I'm where I am with Arsenal now. That wouldn't have happened if I wasn't in the country. So it all, you know, there's pros and cons to everything. But hey-ho. But James, it's been fascinating. Well done. Keep going. As you said, there will be quiet months, but, you know, get through those quiet months and the happy times will always come back and stuff like that, I think. I think there was another one of these podcasts I did. Someone said, like, you know, always remember that a bad time will have an end. It just, you might not see the end, but it will have an end. When it has an end, something good will come. So always think about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this year, 2023, has probably been one of the most difficult years so far since the pandemic. The economy is just so up and down at the minute. And I know I've had difficulties this year. I know many of my peers have struggled in the creative field. So yeah, I would just say, yeah, don't get too downbeat. Keep working hard. And like you say, you know, this too shall pass and we'll have a very good second half of the year. I'm confident of it.
And just very quickly, where can people find you on social and what's your website and all that kind of stuff?
So if you want to find me on social, in terms of LinkedIn, you've just got to search my name, James Cook, Foster Studios, website, fosterstudios.co.uk. And then for Instagram, it's at Foster Studios. And that's just where you can see portfolio of work, essentially.
Just quickly, in sort of 30 seconds, what do Foster Studios do?
So Foster Studios is a small creative, I don't think creative agency is the right word, but production company that specializes in video and photography for businesses of any scale. So when I started the business, I felt there was a really large gap between what is of affordability, but also of quality for smaller businesses. So I really put a big focus on work with SMEs that have got more of a restricted budget and giving them something that they might think has cost thousands upon thousands upon thousands at a good price point. So that's one aspect of the business, but also work with some blue chip clients, the likes of Hamleys, and other large organizations based in the capital, where I do a lot of video content, whether that be corporate, commercial, advertisement. So yeah, video production photography, Foster Studios, get in touch.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the day.
Fantastic. You too, mate. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. And that's a wrap. Thanks for listening to this podcast brought to you by Let's Make a Difference. I was your host, Akil Vyas. Please do follow us on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook. Just search Let's Make a Difference. I think it's Let's Make a Difference Together on Instagram. You'll find us. There are also links in the description below. Please do subscribe on Spotify, Apple or whatever that your choice of platform is for podcasts. Thank you. Have a great day and speak to you soon.